Alison, welcome to Cease and Desist. This has been a long time coming. We've been trying to get this recording locked in for quite some time. And for a bit of background to folks listening, I've always been a bit of a fanboy of Alison's on LinkedIn. Huge sort of, I will say, at the top and at the end of the podcast. Your blog has always been something I've sort of religiously sort of followed and studied for insights. And then I had the pleasure of hearing you speak in person. I think it was the Digital Asset Task Force at Interpol.
Yeah,
I believe it was the one we finally got to properly meet, and I'd sort of convinced you to come onto the podcast because, as everyone knows, the reason this show exists, it's to talk about the stories, the infrastructure, the lead up to what then happens. There's no seized assets if there isn't the asset recovery ecosystem. And the asset recovery ecosystem unfortunately exists because of the problems in illicit finance. And I can't think of anyone better who has a very interesting sort of backstory and covers, you know, this topic very, very broadly. So huge thank you to giving up your time to join us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm really happy to be here. I'm glad we could finally coordinate.
And you were you're the person that has taken on the gauntlet of responding to Nick's clickbait title of "No such thing as crypto crime," and you're like, "Well, what is crypto crime? Maybe we can start there." That you actually you've given it a go in defining crypto crime, and of course, now tell listeners a bit about your background as well, please.
Sure. So, as you said, my name is Alison Jimenez, and I'm the president of Dynamic Securities Analytics. Let's call it DSA because that's a mouthful. So, DSA provide research, compliance consulting, and litigation consulting as an expert witness in financial crime cases. And many of them are money laundering. Enough of that. They're not all crypto, but they're certainly, as the years have gone on, more and more of the cases have involved crypto in one way or another. But as part of the fun thing of being able to run my own business all these years is that I have the ability to write and not have to go through many, many layers of supervisors to get things published. Because I sometimes meet people.
You don't have to be screened.
Yeah, it's like I meet these wonderful people in person. They have these.
I will not be silenced.
And they can't get through the layers of, you know, approvals within their company to get things out the door. So, for better or worse, I'm less filtered and can research things that interest me and write and that's something I enjoy doing.
Well, but listen, in an age of AI generated content, I think the curated by practitioners, curated by humans, will be a hugely valuable commodity when someone can say, "Hey, you wrote this. Give me some of your other opinions," because then that's where most people will struggle. So, let's dive into your definition of crypto crime.
Sure. So, and that was really just in response to Nick's book, which I had read the first one and the second one, and I, you know, learned so much from him and respect him. But I'm like, what does he mean by that? Because we all use the term in one way or the other, and I wanted to understand what he meant. So I read the book and then said, well, this is what I mean when I use the term crypto crime, because I do. I use it and I use it as a hashtag. But I wanted to have a basis for it. So my basis for the definition was similarly, what is cybercrime? And again, yeah, it's not that this crime is a new crime. That's not my criteria, whether the crime is new, but whether in crypto's case, crypto crime could be any variety of illegal activities that target cryptocurrency or make use of cryptocurrency to carry out illicit activities. So it's not whether, you know, kidnapping's new, it's whether cryptocurrency is used to facilitate that activity.
Yeah.
But I do actually separate a little bit crypto crime, where they're actually targeting the crypto, and that might be like a hack or crypto jacking. They're directly targeting the crypto itself versus crypto enabled crime. And again, there's a similar definition for cyber enabled crime. And with crypto enabled crime, you have a traditional criminal activity, and maybe that's drug dealing, but you're facilitating it through cryptocurrency. So say if, you know, crypto disappeared tomorrow, people are still going to be buying and selling drugs. They would just use a different product. But right now, crypto can be helpful for, you know, remitting proceeds across borders. But then I kind of go into a third area of some crimes that would not exist or existed at a much lower level had it not been for the ability to much more easily monetize them through crypto. And that's where I kind of go into my analysis of commercial CSAM. which, you know, CSAM has existed for a long time, but the commercial aspect of being able to buy and sell it for profit, that has really been facilitated by crypto. And that's a, you know, have written extensively about that. And then ransomware is another thing. Like, ransomware has existed. The technology has been there, but it was difficult to monetize that. You could shut down somebody's computer, no problem. But to make money off of it, that was the new trick with using crypto to be able to get those large payments overseas, irreversibly, pseudo-anonymously. So I just wanted to make sure when I'm talking about crypto crime, people understand what I'm saying. And I think it seems like a good idea for the industry and society at large to have a common understanding of what we mean by it. So it's not whether the crime's new, it's about whether it's leveraging crypto to carry out the activity, or actually, you know, targeting the crypto itself, just like cyber might be trying to shut down your computer, or it might be using your computer to be a proxy to hack into somebody else. So it's, how is this tool being used?
And I completely agree. And I know that, I mean, I had the sort of pleasure of, you know, playing a very, very small part as a contributor, and I did a tiny section in Nick's book around asset seizure, and I remember the discussions around the title. You know, it was purposely, you know, yes, done to sort of invoke a response, and it was around the law enforcement reaction. It was almost a way of encouraging people to
not, you know, be intimidated by it.
Yeah, and almost don't undersell yourself. It's like, if you're an investigator, you're an investigator. I mean, what comes across your desk? Of course, there's a hard technical boundary. And, you know, someone can look on a phone. That does not make you a digital forensic expert. But you can still glance at the phone and see what apps are on the phone. And you can use that to inform questions with a suspect. And I know that one of the intentions was to almost reassure people and say, look, we've been here before. I mean, we've gone from the fax machines and the pagers to the mobile phones to smartphones with, you know, 50 gig of data on a personally held device. You know, we've gone through, you know, e-payments and, you know, moving on from traditional banking rails to you know, text message based sort of money transfers to stable coins. And every time it was like, there's always going to be a new thing. You can't just pigeonhole and have one person in an organization that is your crypto person, and it fits neatly and you have a strategy just for crypto. And I really like how you've unpacked it to sort of say, like, it's just, there's just so many ways to consider it. And because there is a particular resourcing requirement around it, you also, you know, almost in the converse to Nick's argument, as the title, you then still need to understand what it is and how it operates and the types and
that sort of weed. Is it that facilitation of a traditional crime, or is it something?
What is it?
Is it there? You know, in some cases, I think cryptojacking, that is a new thing. That was not, you can't do cryptojacking without
terrifying.
Crypto.
Terrifying when you see. Yeah, when you see how many of them are starting to take place, and actually I was going to ask you this later on, but like the large scale cryptojacking. Like, imagine we lived in a society where not only did, you know, crypto millionaires walk around and they're getting kidnapped. What if government agencies start holding, mm-hmm. you know, millions or billions of dollars in strategic reserves? Sure. You had wrote quite a strongly titled blog post around what you feel is the risk. Would you be kind enough to sort of unpack that for the sure. listeners as to what strategic reserves, what risks they could pose?
Sure. So I was looking at the strategic reserves mainly from a national security risk, but there's also the risk of, you know, that the poor government employees in charge of the stockpile getting kidnapped or his family kidnapped, yeah. you know, under threat if you don't provide the, you know, the private key or the access to this. But from a national security standpoint, and specifically in the United States, there was an initial proposal to have a Bitcoin strategic reserve. And that's what this was about. Not, there's some other discussions of adding other tokens to it. But my article is about the Bitcoin strategic reserve. And one thing
for context for international listeners, this was off the back of the executive order.
So it says, sure. Yeah, so I actually wrote this before the election, when it was just a campaign promise of, you know, President Trump said, I'm going to have a Bitcoin strategic reserve. All the seized cryptos, we're going to hold on to those and have it as a strategic reserve. So I kind of also unpack, what is a strategic reserve? You know, when we think of oil or
Petroleum and gas and things
like that. So trying to understand what does that even mean? And then once he was elected president, there was the executive order making that an official move that the U.S. wants to do. But I wanted to understand what is a strategic reserve? That's not something I normally deal with, but I do deal with cryptocurrency. So trying to understand interplay between those. And something that's concerned me for a while is if it's a Bitcoin strategic reserve, we talk about the decentralization of Bitcoin, but those are different, you know, computers that are running nodes and doing validating, but the same, you know, one or two or three companies make all of those chips. So it's very centralized of who is making those chips, and especially what country that the United States does not always get along with is the source country of those chips. So you could have many separate computers running the blockchain, but if they're all vulnerable to one cyber attack because they're made by the same company, or they're all using the same firmware that can be injected by North Korea or Iran, that decentralization shows how uncentralized it can be very quickly. So whether it's if the U.S. get in a trade war with China, and China says, "All right, we're just not going to ship any more Bitcoin mining computers to you." Okay, well, that's an easy way. Or if they have in the hardware backdoors or the software backdoors, there's a lot of ways. And we've seen in the United States many hardware items that were built or manufactured in China have access to the CCP. They have access to them. So I don't know why we wouldn't consider that in the Bitcoin strategic reserve. You know, if we're relying on hardware that is almost entirely exclusively built by Chinese companies, that would not be a risk we'd want to consider and perhaps try to mitigate or not put ourselves in the position as a country where we're vulnerable to it. If you're an individual and you're holding Bitcoin and any other crypto, like that's, if you want to speculate, that's fine. But when you're putting US government reserves into something that could be, hacked or controlled by a nation state that we don't always see eye to eye on, that's a risk. And then it's interesting, especially with Bitcoin using the proof of work, is that, you know, if in Texas they already have rolling blackout issues and they pay their Bitcoin miners to not.
Well, I was just about to ask you, is there like an American version of this that could mitigate against those risks? Is there like an America first way that you could,
you know, deal with
that supply chain problem?
The one suggestion I had, and I would love more people to think about this and write about it. Mm-hmm. My suggestion was, this is the route we want to go, then we need to have an American Bitcoin mining rig, one that we're building mm-hmm. using our chips that needs to be competitive, because it is, you know, with Bitcoin, you need to have the best machine, the fastest machine, the most efficient machine. So we need to be competitive with that and not rely upon China to do that for us.
You wouldn't rely on China, I imagine, to build all of your missiles and an arsenal and any other sort of weaponry.
We don't even want them using building our cell phone communication tower. So why would we have our strategic reserves entirely reliant upon the ability of machines that are built in China? It seems a very how can you be the Bitcoin capital of the world if all your machines and software are reliant upon one of your main adversaries? We need to have our own response if we're going to go down that route.
And look, at the time of recording this, we're seeing Bitcoin at an all-time high. I'm sure that we're going to once again see the debate raging, because it is becoming a little bit politicized now, in the sense of if you want the crypto vote. I almost think of it back to the different demographics in cycles over the years that politicians have targeted. Do you feel that that's kind of what's happening a little bit with, you've been around this space for a long time. I mean, are you as surprised? Some of the commentators, people like Molly White and others, she highlights in her podcast and her blog, Citation Needed, she talks about the fact that she's almost just in shock that the crypto companies that were from this sort of cyberpunk era are sponsoring military parades and stuff. And it just doesn't. So, which is it? The chicken and egg? Is it the politicians' populist vote, or is it the crypto companies realizing, no, we need to just be like the big corporates if we want the adoption? What's your thoughts?
Sure. So something I included in a little bit broader, pulling back just from the Bitcoin Reserve to irregular warfare as a whole and the use of cryptocurrency is one of the most recent surveys we have of how many Americans actually use or held crypto was 8% in 2024, which, you know, is that's a government survey versus a survey conducted by a crypto company. So 8% isn't very much. I was trying to find like what other thing do 8% of Americans use, you know, hearing aids, Rolls Royces, like it's okay. It would affect those people.
Give me a comparable demographic.
Like it would affect those 8%.
Tortoise owners.
But the
other
92%, unless it's in a Bitcoin strategic reserve, it doesn't really affect me if the prices go up or down. But the outweighed influence on the government of the, despite the fact that only 8% of Americans actually use or hold, the influence that you see on the government right now is much larger than the percentage of Americans actually using it. And that kind of goes into my thesis about irregular warfare. And if whether government officials themselves are involved in cryptocurrency businesses, operations, or their main donors are heavily involved in cryptocurrency operations, and there's some threat to cryptocurrency, will our decision to, say, defend Taiwan be influenced by, well, if we do that, then China will retaliate by not allowing Bitcoin mining machines to be exporting United States, or they will
create that interdependency.
Yeah, that leverage of, you know, and it won't be the first time. Like I was thinking about historically, say all the oil and fossil fuel companies, like they had a very strong government pool and weight. But I would say many more people were using petroleum products than cryptocurrency. So it's not like the first time that government officials will have to say, well, how does it affect the industry? And then also that pain can be pushed down, like go back to the 70s of, well, this affects people standing in line at gas pumps waiting for gas. If,
yeah, when the shortages.
If people are like up in arms because, you know, suddenly my Bitcoin's down to 2 cents because North Korea hacked the strategic reserve, there might be some pushback of, well, let's not get involved. Or maybe it'd be the opposite of like, okay, that was the wrong button to push. Now we're really going to go after our adversary. So I can't predict exactly how it's going to go, but it has this political leverage of either it's going to influence, certain actions or, influence actions not to be taken because they don't want their industry to be negatively impacted. And that's, again, it's not unique to crypto, but it is a new industry that has a very large influence on the current government.
Yeah, it does seem to be, to use the term, sort of punching above its weight. And I don't mean that. I mean that objectively. I don't mean that with any bias either way. It, as you say, for the actual amount, the actual value, it really has no grab the imagination. And that sort of leads me into a very common question that everyone gets asked all the time, but I purposely ask it of anyone I speak to, not just the podcast, because there's always a chance of just different perspectives. So why do you think bad actors are using, arguably the most traceable asset on earth? Why are we seeing such a use of illicit? And we'll also then get onto the illicit use statistic. But why do you think bad actors are using crypto? What's your perspective?
Sure. So I my response is, well, which bad guys are using it? Why? And crypto, it is interesting and neat and unique in that it can do so many different things in one product that others can't. People usually point first to the anonymity. And then they'll also say, well, it's not really anonymous, so it's not a good tool. I said, well, checks aren't anonymous. Credit cards aren't anonymous. Like the only, the only product that really is anonymous is cash. But checks and credit cards are used to launder money. So that's not the only thing bad guys care about. They also care about, how much money can you send at once? Can I steal $1.5 billion in one, 3-minute transaction? You can't do a $1.5 billion theft in gift cards. This just doesn't work. Can you move money across borders? A lot of, try mailing a check to Nigeria. It will maybe get there. Maybe it won't. Can it move money across borders? Can it move it quickly? Again, even a wire takes a couple days. And I certainly understand when the Bitcoin advocates say, well, these are also reasons why it's great because you can move things quickly across borders. But from a bad guy's perspective, especially transnational organized crime, that want to move a lot of money across borders quickly. Maybe it's anonymous, maybe it's not. I'm a ransomware gang. I'm in Russia. What are you going to do about it? it's not their only concern. It's not reversible like a credit card might be. You can send it to third parties, you know, some investment products. I can only send money from an account in my name to another account in my name. So there are things you can do with crypto that you can't do with other products. And each bad guy, I'm someone who is a commercial CSAM operator, you know, that I can be in Philippines and receive funds from folks in the United States and the UK. That's going cross borders. I'm not really concerned about getting $1.5 billion at a time, but $30 or 30 tethers at a time is plenty, because people want anonymity. And they might not use Bitcoin or Tether. They might use Monero or something that provides more anonymity. So it really depends on what is your business model as an illicit actor. Are you trying to steal as much as you can? You know, that's a great tool for that. Are you trying to get it across borders? That's a great tool for that. Are you trying to hide your tracks behind a pseudonymous system? That can be helpful in that. And the good guys are getting better. So it is a bit of cat and a mouse in that. But it's the myopic focus solely on anonymity. Like that's been disproved now. It's not completely anonymous, but it's also not the only thing bad guys care about.
Yeah, and that's why I'm delighted to ask you this question, because that's a new perspective that I've heard back articulated the way you have just done it. And if I frame that in a way that I understand from my perspective of, I often find that I'm the person in the room that, you know, really enjoys the technology, really sees the benefits of crypto, but I don't drink the Kool-Aid in the sense of I completely, you know, as someone that's been involved in, you know, investigations and asset seizures linked to CSAM cases, I mean, I can't unsee what I've seen, and I can't unsee this. As you say, criminals don't care. Criminals care about detection. And if they look at traditional payment rails and think there's a good chance we won't get spotted, it's the classic thing of, you know, the cartels doing 100 shipments a day, happy to lose 20 because they know the 80 is getting through. It's just profit margins and ROI. And that all of the work that has been done globally for decades, and, you know, it's a podcast in itself to talk about the effectiveness of the current existing money laundering, you know, controls, and just how I know an author we had on the podcast, Oliver Bullo, you know, has very clear, very firm views on, you know, what he feels that, you know, we could have cured world starvation or something like twice over with the amount of money has been spent on anti-money laundering controls collectively as a global sort of community. And one could argue, you know, we still have trillions laundered and we don't have trillions recovered, let alone even investigated. I mean, but there's lots of success stories. So it seems like there's almost been this, if we zoom out and don't look at, you know, days, weeks, and quarters, and months. If we look at decades, there's been a decades-long problem from the 70s with the Bank Secrecy Act. Everything was really accelerated after 9/11. Patriot Act brought in, and I'm citing Amanda Wick. I'm not going to pretend it's my research. Amanda pointed out in her new book that, you know, a lot of this stuff was on the books. It was just really like weaponized and incentivized with the Patriot Act and things like that. So arguably, all of this infrastructure has been in place. The effectiveness hasn't been great. That's why FATF, and that's me being diplomatic. That's why there was this renewed focus on asset recovery. And it just seems, I can almost imagine as someone who, you know, works like in an interagency sort of government capacity, just watching crypto coming over the horizon and just going, no. Oh dear God.
Yeah.
Like all the things we've been trying to shut down. Yeah. And if I'm a criminal, and again, credit where credit's due. I was at a book launch for an FT journalist, Miles Johnson, Chasing Shadows, his book. He's going to be a guest on the podcast soon. And he does this fascinating insight into the interoperability of the, you know, the criminal money laundering network.
Yes.
And it is almost like, you know, someone, if you go back to an Escobar style, you know, character that was losing, was it a couple of hundred million or something, or they estimated he lost like a billion over his lifetime in like cash being eaten and deteriorating because he just simply didn't have the payment rails.
Yes.
If you had someone like him nowadays, he would just look at crypto and be like, good God, what? I can do all of this. And it's kind of like the interoperability of criminality, where maybe the cartels have logistics where the Russian cyber gangs have laundering as a service, and maybe then you've got the laundering facilities and the actual the sextortion and the things that's coming out of like the Golden Triangle in Southeast Asia. So you've got all of these groups working together because they bring about, and he tracks it in his book, showing that like the literally business transactional relationships between, which anyone in law enforcement will not be surprised by. But I think the scale, and it goes back to the my favorite Spider-Man quote, with great great power comes great responsibility. Mm-hmm. I think the reason crypto probably gets picked on the way it does is because it presents such a higher risk than any technology we've seen previously. Because as you mentioned, it does so many things for so many bad actors. And if you look at it from a business operations point of view, it just makes everything so much more frictionless for them.
Useful. It's a very useful tool for bad guys. Go back to, that 8% figure of Americans, and they even break it down to, did you use it to send remittances to family overseas? And I have the wonderful benefit of being an American, so I don't have to, most Americans never even leave the country. I don't have to leave the country. I don't have to do a lot of international transactions. Yeah. So for me, I don't need to make maybe one or two overseas payments.
You don't have that forced perspective.
It's a different perspective. And I understand when they talk about the Argentinian programmer who's working remotely. Like, I understand that. But for my
Or like the innocent Iranian families who aren't involved in the conflict and just want to live and they can't bloody.
Sure. Yeah. But that still seems specific use cases versus the discussion of like, this is going to be the next big thing for me. If anyone wants money from me quickly overseas, it's a scam. I don't have family that's in a disaster zone in Turkey, and I could kind of understand those situations, but I don't see that the tremendous growth that's being suggested with the wider adoption of stablecoins, how that's going to help, most Americans for their daily transactions. I don't have that needing to make large payments overseas irreversibly. That's just not something that comes up in my life or most Americans' lives on a daily basis. Does it come up for businesses on occasion, for other folks in other places? Yes. But is that small number of use cases worth the large risk? And if you're going to push for more stablecoin usage, wider adoption, how are you going to mitigate that risk? Because does every transaction need to be open to irreversibility and sending it overseas when you meant to send it to your babysitter for payment? So these are questions that, if like you're talking about the great responsibility, who's going to be responsible for when it goes wrong? Because right now it seems to be the other Spider-Man meme where everyone's pointing fingers at somebody else.
Another one. And again, I think it's also mainstream media and politicians and general public. We're all guilty of just mushing it all together as one category and separating out what is phenomenal technology against a scam operator, against a perfectly well-intentioned protocol or product or exchange, or a money laundering as a service. And it's drawing those battle lines. I would love to close out then with, and I think we've naturally come to this conclusion point then. So like, illicit use of crypto, we've highlighted why bad actors use it. We've highlighted the sheer scale of the ROI it adds to bad actors for all the different various use cases, particularly. And again, I will share a link to your blog and the notes that goes out with this post. But often hotly debated is the illicit use of crypto. Analytic companies will say it's a certain figure, and the minute they put those reports out, there's always a wild debate that takes place on LinkedIn. Like, what's your views on that? And maybe if you could unpack for us your understanding of how those figures are constructed, or assumptions, and just what people should be aware of when they read those figures.
Sure. So by training, I'm an economist. So looking at numbers and data, that's my jam. So when I saw numbers like that, I was like, oh, that's really interesting. And then I will go and read the footnotes. And then if I don't understand the footnotes, I will actually message the person who wrote the report saying, how did you, it's not a academic.
What sort of response do you get? Get a response to those messages?
Fair play. It might help because they know that I actually write about this. And if they have a response, I'll include that in my blog comment. So other financial products, and maybe it's an issue with other financial products, they are not measuring the amount of illicit use against all transactions. That's just not a metric that's used for any other financial product. So when you see the metric for crypto, it's really kind of a standalone thing that the analytic companies invented. And it's their metric, so they can invent whatever metric they want. The nominator, the number on top, is the dollar value of the illicit activity. And even that, their definition and what that numerator includes has changed over the years. You know, going back, and I will go back and read every report of years ago, it had included any illicit funds that went in or out of an address. So if, you know, there was a hack and funds went into a wallet and sat there, then that was the value. If it moved to another wallet, that was also an illicit flow that was counted. Now, they only count funds that go to an illicit address. So it's the definition also keeps changing slightly each year. And again, there's not too many folks that keep track of that. It's their metric. They can define it however they want. But even comparing year to year gets a little tricky because the definitions change. What I have an issue with is that the denominator on the bottom, they've been using all cryptocurrency transactions. Now, cryptocurrency transactions, for example, with the Heartland Bank case, which was the bank president who embezzled funds. He was in, sounds like he was in a romance scam or pig butchering, and convinced to buy crypto. And they had some recent indictments that came out with some details on that. Mm-hmm. One of the payments, you know, he bought crypto, and then they followed that through 13 different wallet addresses till it eventually landed somewhere. If you're looking at the denominator, you'll see 13 times of that money moving from wallet to wallet to wallet. And that inflates the denominator, making the original illicit activity very small. So I would say 100% of the activity was illicit, but you know the analytics would be, you know, only one out of those 13 transactions was illicit. So it's a little bit confusing. And then they only know certain transactions are illicit. They don't know everything. Again, that's something where I kind of push back, because right now most people think the analytics companies, if you're not dealing with it every day, they either tag something as licit or illicit. But there's this whole gray area, which is really hard to nail down, of each company. Well, what percentage of transactions are unknown? And it could be, again, this is something I spent time researching. Is it 30% are unknown? Is it 70% are unknown? Yeah. But right now, if it's unknown, that's just considered licit. It's not categorized either way.
It's just on that point, I think it is, and again, to be fair to you know, the analytic companies, they can't control often the, you know, mainstream quotation. I mean, I've seen, for example, in, you know, Chainalysis reports where, you know, the headline will, you know, CoinDesk, CoinTelegraph will report, Chainalysis says it's less than 1%. Sure. And if you actually read the report, it will say of what we've tracked on chain.
Yep, they've gotten better. And I would say that's because for years I was hammering on that point. I'm like, put in some caveats, put in some footnotes.
Because the average person doesn't know that. I mean, no one can see the off-chain side. Yes. So,
and that's my other point. This percentage is only the on-chain, which is, again, depending on the year, 10%, 20%.
It's almost like the press. Yeah, yeah. It's almost like the press needs to say, we absolutely know with certainty it's this minimum amount.
Yeah. Like, that's the dollar base value. Level. Like, that's fine. It's when it goes in the percentage.
It's interesting, yeah.
Because as we talked about earlier, the value of cryptocurrency fluctuates wildly. So if last year there was, say, $50 billion in illicit activity, but the value of Bitcoin doubles this year, so the percentage gets smaller because the value of Bitcoin doubles. Is there less crime, or is it just because the value of Bitcoin doubled? Like, that doesn't make there less crime.
Yeah. So a $20 theft in 1745
exactly.
is a pretty big theft. Yeah,
when crypto tanks, because it has its ups and downs, and crime is still $50 billion, but the, you know, value of crypto has
the
all gone down.
Shrunk.
Are they going to say crime increased by 150%? I don't think that's going to be the headline. I think there'll be some sort of caveat of they're going to switch to dollar value. Well, the dollar value went from 50 to 51 billion, so it was a small increase. If the denominator ever, you know, when we ever have the next the crash, so the percentage is where I find it to be confusing or non-comparable or not relevant to other transactions. And especially if they try to compare it. And I would say the analytics companies have backed away from trying to compare it to like the GDP percentage of crime, which again, that was just a best guess. And again, as an economist, GDP and all transactions are entirely different. You know, I'd say it's like comparing 2% milk to 98% unleaded gasoline. They are two different calculations. Just because they're both percentages, it doesn't mean they're comparable. But that gets quantitative and I lose people on that. But, you know, I can make up a metric.
Yeah, but I think where you can definitely get a consensus of opinion is that if we all already agree that it's an imperfect assumptions that are being made in TradFi, then we can't have it all figured out in crypto because we've proven we don't know the top figure. So everything else underneath, so what argument? No, 10% of people have this new infection. What's the population? We don't know.
Yeah.
So what's the 10% number? We don't know what the illicit number is, and people forget that. I mean, the UNODC, if you look at any reports on illicit finance, they always report back to a source document, and everyone usually points fingers at UNODC and says, UNODC says it's probably 4-6% of GDP. You ask an investigative journalist, Misha Glenny, the author, in his TED Talk, he reckons the crime is 15% of GDP, and it's like, everyone's just like, they're just assumptions being made. But we can all agree it's an enormous number. And I like your point of being much more transparent about the unknowns. Because again, if I'm a criminal today and I'm in the middle of, and this isn't specific to any blockchain company, this is just the way the world works. You don't know until after the event. Most times when I see someone walking down the street today with a briefcase, I don't know that he's laundering money. But if I read the news in 3 days' time that an individual ran through London city centre with a big briefcase, we now know that that was a crime after the event. So all of the current activity that's taking place right now, that could be an enormous FBI investigation or Australian Federal Police or Met Police, we won't know as members of the public reading these reports. We won't know that when that investigation is done, is there then retrospective, no attribution carried out? And I'm sure that does happen in the big firms. Yeah,
it's interesting because you go back from year to year, like, oh, last year they said it was $25 billion, and now it, I have a graph of that. And now it's $40 billion last year. But I appreciate blockchain and looks, it is helpful. But when it's used to say that crypto crime isn't a problem because it's a small percentage, that's where I disagree.
Yeah. And you know what? I would agree with, I think that the analytic companies know can present data. I think where it goes wrong, and again, I'm not, I don't want to be seen as if I'm trying to, let the analytic companies off the hook, but they present data. I mean, often it's usually politically and media driven. It's selective to suit a narrative. And it's like, because I've seen it in both sides. And I mean, I've been a contractor for the UNODC during COVID. We were doing assessments in different countries about their internal asset recovery infrastructure and their response to dealing with illicit assets and digital assets. And I've seen like literally the black and white comparison of someone holding up an analytic report going, we should definitely be doing more about this because it's a wonderful technology and it's great and the stats are low. Mm-hmm. And I've seen the same report being taken to say, oh my God, there's so much illicit crypto and we could be seizing it. And actually, we should ban it. We want anything to do with that in our country. And it's just, it can be misused and misrepresented. And I think enough people don't understand because it is, it is very imperfect, as you say, because there's just simply so many unknowns in it. What do you think? Is there a, with the economist hat on, is there a better way of doing it? Or is it simply a case of it's probably just not possible and it isn't imperfect and it's more about the disclaimers and the caveats? Because the underlying data, if it's consistent, the trends are useful. And like you say, I think it is really important as part of like prevention and detection and awareness and consumer education. You need the headline saying another $8 billion was lost to scams.
I think we keep it
for
in the
people
dollar
to take
value,
it seriously.
That is fine. Just that the when it tries to get translated into percentages, it gets unclear of what are we actually measuring here and why and to what end are we producing this number. But the dollar figure of X dollars were lost in scams or X dollars were lost in ransomware that we know of on the blockchain doesn't include the ones that are within exchanges. It's useful information and it gives people, areas to pursue and investigate and strengthen. But the percentages, that's mainly where I have my biggest concern, that it's use in ways that somehow minimize the impact of crypto crime. And I think the dollar figures. And as when I testified for Congress, I had the opportunity to talk about this. This is one resource of information. We have other resources. We have suspicious activity reports that include dollar values. We have consumer complaints. We have FTC complaints. We have IC3 complaints. So this should not be the only sole source of dollar loss figures or number of victimization, because those complaints and SARs also include that off-chain component. So, again, just having that as our only source of information or ignoring these other sources, it's doing a disservice to the victims. And we have other information, we might as well use it and try to do it in a way that prevents some of the crime instead of just responding. As somebody who's an anti-money laundering practitioner, follow the money. That also means the bad guy already has the money. So let's try and prevent some of that. And on your end, like, okay, they have the money. Let's seize it back.
Take it off them. Yeah.
So like I've done so much of my career is following the money. I really would like to get into more of the let's prevent it from getting stolen in the first place. And that information is useful of like, okay, is it a romance scam? How do we educate the financial institutions from the banks where the money initially comes from to the crypto companies, to the consumers, which consumers? So I like having a broader source of information from SARs, from banks, from consumer complaints to inform how we approach the problem.
And I think that the more healthy debates, the better. The more data, the better. I think that where we have a really unique opportunity that we didn't have in traditional finance is the opportunity to create accountability, because it's getting those charges on TradFi organizations, the multiple banks that have been involved in sanctions evasions and things like that. Again, with great power comes great responsibility. With all of this data, should come better accountability, and should come more swifter compliance related enforcement as well. But I suppose that will remain to be seen. Alison, to wrap things up, if you have all of the asset recovery practitioners and political leaders of the world listening to you today, what's the request, or what would you ask them to do if you had the podium?
Sure. So having listened to many of your podcasts, taking away the financial incentive of crimes is, I think, key. And one that particularly I've been passionate about the past year is financially motivated sextortion of children. The bad guys are blackmailing children with the child self-generated nude image for money. And they're getting that money across borders to West Africa through cryptocurrency. Making the victim whole by returning $300, I don't think that's that's not the victim's priority. They'd rather not have that image out there. But taking away the profit motivation of the sextortionists, of the CSAM operators, of the money mules who are getting, 10% cut for letting transactions flow through their accounts by seizing their assets, I think taking away the monetization of these crimes would be a good move, although it doesn't necessarily make all victims whole. In case of a hack or ransomware, it may, but some of these really horrific crimes of CSAM, it's for the victim, it's not about getting that payment back. It's about preventing bad guys from targeting victims in the first place by taking away the financial incentive. If you take away the profit motivation, then some of these crimes like sextortion, like commercial CSAM, will occur less. And that's what I hope law enforcement policymakers take away from how that can be impactful. If they can't make money from it, it will happen less and there'll be less victims.
It's just it's yet another wonderful and poignant reason why asset recovery as a strategy, not just following the money, doing something about it afterwards, can have such an important effect. Alison, like I say, I recommend everybody follows your blog and gets into it. I love this sector and the fact that everyone doesn't have to agree on everything as well.
Sure.
That's kind of the point, is that we can all have sort of phenomenal and debates and discussions.
The fun thing with crypto is like, it's so new and evolving. There's always, there's there's plenty of viewpoints.
Beware the experts.
Yeah, just choose a lane and go with it, because there's not enough folks thinking critically about the issues. There's a lot of you know, parroting of, well, I saw this number, I saw this headline, but like dive into something. I would love more people to be looking at this.
Come and disagree with you.
Please, or even things already written, disagree. Tell me where I'm wrong. I'm not saying I'm right about everything, but I would love more get me to think about it differently.
Listen, kudos for actually, you know, putting it out there, because you're absolutely right. Most people will share their opinions in corners and they would never, ever air them publicly. And I think the more of that gets done, then the more of it gets discussed. We have podcasts like this, and hopefully then we can sort of continue the debate going. And hopefully this time we're checking in this time next year and we're seeing extraordinary results in digital asset recovery, yes, continuing around the world and having the impact you talked about. But I think geopolitical events over the next couple of years will probably
dictate
the direction that everything goes in. Interesting times. That's the diplomatic way we'll close there. But Alison, thank you so much for giving up your time. I'm glad we sort of persevered with our schedules to get this done. I'm really grateful. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Aidan.
Our podcasts are for informational purposes only. They are not intended to provide legal, tax, financial, and/or investment advice. Listeners must consult their own advisors before making any decisions on the topics being discussed.